I'd like to give you a short course in nutrition. This will involve the composition of foods and also involve nutritional recommendations. The American diet is hardly believed by many to cause any problems whatsoever. After all, isn't it the diet that your mother taught you to eat? Isn't it the diet that food manufacturers tell us are good for you? Isn't it the diet that the National Dairy Council said you have to have at least 12 gallons of milk a day in order to make you healthy and have your bones get strong? Now, the American diet is sort of a disaster, and I'll tell you why. First of all, it's very high in fat. Almost half the total calories are in fat on the American diet, and simple sugar is one-fifth of your total calories. In fact, if we take the fat and sugar together, that's almost two-thirds of all your calories. And yet fat and sugar have no vitamins, no minerals, no dietary fiber, that is, no roughage, and they're really a disaster for you. In fact, the average American eats 6 ounces of sugar and 6 ounces of fat a day. Well, that's 1,500 calories, and it's only 12 ounces. If you had 12 ounces of salad, that would only be 80 calories. That's why the average American inevitably has to become overweight, because when you're eating 6 ounces, and it's fat and 6 ounces of sugar, that's 1,500 calories. That's usually all you need all day long, and yet you eat that in one meal. Because the stomach is not too considerate as to what you put in it. The stomach is concerned about filling it mechanically, just putting so much material in before it satisfies its hunger. And the stomach doesn't really know if you're putting in 12 ounces worth of salad or if you're putting in 12 ounces of very high calorie foods, simple sugars and fats. It just wants to be filled mechanically. So it's very easy, and it's almost impossible not to put too many calories in your stomach because the food is refined. It's just the pure calories without the bulk in which a food was intended originally in form to be eaten. So Americans, about a third of Americans after they're adults, weigh too much, and it's not their fault. It's because the simple refined foods force too many calories with too little bulk into their stomachs and force them then to become overweight. Not only do you have problems with sugar and fat, but white flour, which is the other 15 or 20% of what people eat, is without vitamins, minerals, dietary fiber, except for a few they might put back. And so that 80 or 85% of everything you eat is highly worth eating. There are artificial foods. The only thing that saves Americans at about 10% of their calories are fruits and vegetables. That's the only real food they eat. So the American diet is unforgivable. Plus the third of an ounce of salt the average American eats. This forces him to hold so much water in his tissues that he starts to lose his circulation, develop arthritis, raise his blood pressure, and do all kinds of wrong things. Now, there's other things wrong with the American diet, such as the amount of chemicals in the diet. It's hard for you to believe, but since World War II, there's 1,000% more food colorings in your foods. Now, did you ask for all those food colorings? No, the food manufacturers decided that if they put it in, maybe you'll buy their products. They think you love to have these pretty colors from coal tires and so on. Now, these are a disaster for you. And unfortunately, some of the food colors have been turned out to be carcinogenic. But that's all right. We can change them and give you other food colors that we don't know really what's going to happen until another 5 or 10 years. And then when we find out they're bad, we'll change those. The idea is to sell the food, not to make it healthier. How about the high-protein diet that every American eats? You know, the average American eats 3 times as much protein as his body requires. And that's a disaster for the person eating it because a high-protein diet leads to many problems. It cuts your endurance way down. It gives you constant fatigue because of the waste products of the protein accumulating in your blood. It can give you kidney damage. It forces minerals out of your bones and out of your blood, giving you mineral depletion. And in general, it's a real problem for the body. I'm going to talk about more of those things. Before I do, I'd like to give you some idea of what foods are made of, because you don't think about fats, sugars, carbohydrates, and so on. You think of an apple, you think of an orange, you think of apple pie, you think of foods. So let's talk about foods. Well, first, people have a mistaken conception of what foods are made of. Just to tell you again, we're going to talk about proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. Now, all of these are found in foods together. They're not separate. When you talk about a protein food, you really don't mean it unless you're talking about the white of egg. That's pure protein. But when you talk about cheese, for example, many people think of cheese as a protein food. It is not. Cheese has only as much protein as beans or peas. It's a fat food. Over 70% of the total calories of cheese is in fat. Butter is only 82% fat. So when you eat cheese, you're essentially eating butter. In fact, cheese has more fat and cholesterol than steak. So if you think you're doing yourself a favor eating cheese, you better eat steak. Now, as far as fruits are concerned, fruits are all quite low in fats. They're usually less than 10% fat. They're high in carbohydrates, usually over 80%, and they're relatively low in protein. For example, a banana has about 2% of its total calories in fat. Yet many people believe that bananas are fattening. How can they be fattening with so little fat? They have a lot of bulk for the amount of calories they have. No, bananas aren't fattening. How about potatoes? People think potatoes are fattening. Well, potatoes have less than 1% of the total calories in fat. A potato doesn't have any more calories than an apple or a pear. How can that be fattening? Well, if you take a 100-calorie potato and you put 300 calories of butter on it, that can be fattening. But the potato itself, we consider a medium-calorie food. It's not high calorie. In fact, if you want to go on a diet of just potatoes and bananas and stuff yourself all you can for 30 days, you'll have a tough time maintaining your weight. You'll probably lose weight because you couldn't eat enough to have excess calories. These are natural foods, and that would probably be the reason. Now, most vegetables are fine, and we don't have any problems with them. They're usually relatively low in fat, high in carbohydrates, and moderate in protein. Lettuce, for example, is 9% total calories in fat, 17% protein. It's an excellent food, a lot of minerals and vitamins, and the 9% fat are mostly polyunsaturated fats, which is just what the American Heart Association would like you to have. Except we'd like to have you eat it in food, not by adding corn oil to your food. Now, there's a few restrictions in food, and that is avocado and olives are very high in fat. Avocado is 82% total calories in fat. It's exactly the same as butter. I'm afraid you can't do much with avocado, and we can't recommend it. How about olives? 89% total calories in fat. Well, but we don't restrict you in olives. If you like to, you can have one a day. Now, as far as the grains are your principal caloric source. If you take a look at rice, wheat, barley, millet, and so on, you'll find that they're all relatively low in fat. They're usually below 10% of the total calories in fat. Remember, the American diet is 43% total calories in fat, so they're quite low in fat. And grains are reasonable in protein. They run for about 7 to 15% total calories in protein. Studies have indicated that the human only needs about 6% of its total calories in protein. That means if you're on a 2,000-calorie diet, you'd only need about 120 calories of protein to take care of all your needs, 6% of total calories. The diet I prescribe is about 13% total calories in protein. So you're going to get twice as much as you require on the diet I prescribe. There's no chance in the world to get into a protein deficiency. You get far more than you require. And as far as the various grains and so on, they are all low to moderate in protein. It'll keep your kidneys from getting into trouble, and it will give you all the advantages of low-protein diets I'm going to go into in a moment. Now, as far as beans and peas generally run about 20 or 25% total calories in protein. They're low in fat, and they are about 60 to 70% or so carbohydrates. So beans and peas are a good source of calories, and it gives you some changes in your diet. But we do recommend that you don't eat them three times a day because you'll eat too much protein. Once a day in small portions or three times a week, beans or peas are fine. As far as potatoes, you can eat all you like. As I mentioned, they're low in calories, moderate in calories. They're low in fat, very low in fat. They're good in protein, and they have a lot of good things in them. So as far as the vegetable foods, the foods grown from the ground, you can just about have any variety you like. And we do recommend, of course, the fruits and vegetables, the whole grains, beans and peas and potatoes as your basic source of calories. On our diet, we do permit you to have a certain amount of animal protein, fish and fowl, but we have to be careful about animal protein because of cholesterol. Cholesterol is a real problem. We're going to discuss that on heart disease. But I should tell you this, that if you eat more cholesterol than you lose through your body every day, the excess will pile up in your tissues, your organs, in your arteries, all over your body and destroy you. As it piles up in your arteries, you know what happens there. You grow sort of a cholesterol boil that we call a plaque. And as this boil grows inside your arteries, especially your coronary arteries that lead to your heart, the more the boil grows, the less room there is for blood to flow. And gradually it chokes up your blood supply and you can die of what we call heart disease. Now, heart disease is a bad name because you people might think that there's something wrong with your heart. Well, there's nothing wrong with your heart unless you've had a heart attack. The problem with heart disease is not the heart. It's the coronary arteries, the little vessels that are meant to feed the heart as blood, because the heart is only a muscle, like the calf muscle or your arm muscle, and what it requires is blood to do its work. And if you don't have enough blood flowing through your coronary arteries, the heart can't work, and it cries out in great pain. We call that angina. So that heart disease is the narrowing or closing of your arteries with these cholesterol boils that come from eating too much cholesterol. Now, how much cholesterol is there in food, and where do you find it? The only foods that have cholesterol are those that we call the animal protein foods. Animal protein or animal foods comprise any foods that do not have roots. If it doesn't grow in the ground, it's an animal protein. Animal protein ranges from cows, lambs, cockroaches, houseflies. Anything that doesn't have roots is an animal protein. And the amount of cholesterol varies in these. Now, the most amount of cholesterol that you can eat is no more than what you lose every day. Now, the major use for cholesterol in the body is to make bile. Bile is digestive juice that's used to help digest fat in the body. And probably 70% of the production of cholesterol is used to make bile. Now, it's so hard to make it that the bile, as it goes through the small intestine, is recaptured at the end of the small intestine, and it's brought back to the liver where it's reused. But the body isn't completely efficient, so about 5 or 10% of the bile doesn't recapture and goes on through the large intestine and out with the bowel movement. This bile that goes out is the only way you can lose cholesterol. And the amount of loss you have every day is equivalent to amount of cholesterol in about a pound or pound and a half of fish or fowl a week. If you eat more than that, it stores in your body and creates these terrible problems like gallstones, cholesterol boils in your arteries that we call plaques, and all other kinds of consequences of too much cholesterol. So that we have to limit cholesterol to no more than you lose every day. To give you an idea now of which animal products create problems. Egg yolks are very, very rich in cholesterol. Therefore, we cannot use them in our diet. One egg yolk has as much cholesterol as a half a pound of steak. So if you eat a three-egg omelet, you're eating a pound and a half of steak in cholesterol. And as far as various organ meats and so on, chicken liver has 10 times more cholesterol per ounce than chicken, than white of chicken, white meat of chicken. So you certainly don't want to eat the organ meats because they'll just overwhelm your body with cholesterol. Perhaps the highest amount of cholesterol content that's commonly eaten is in the brain. The animals' brains have 25 times more cholesterol than white meat of chicken or white meat of turkey. So you can't have that. The best thing to do is to stay away from all organ meats. Stay with the white meat of chicken, white meat of turkey, and you can have many fishes. The white meat of turkey and chicken are about 20% of the total calories and fat, about 80% protein. And if you add 2 to 3 ounces a day as an average for a week, that's about the maximum you can have. As far as fish is concerned, most fish is all right. Most fish is rather low in fat. Tuna, for example, is only 6% total calories and fat. That's if it's water-packed. But if you have oil-packed tuna, it's 10 times more in fat than water-packed tuna. And you can't wash the oil off of oil-packed tuna. So your best bet is just to get water-packed and give up the idea of oil-packed tuna. As far as the other normal fishes, codfish, many other fishes are fine. Now, one fish that we use, salmon, is about 50% of its total calories in fat. But it has such a strong flavor, we're able to use it anyway. Because even a quarter ounce of salmon can make up one salmon patty. It has such a strong flavor, it carries through the whole patty. And so we use it in our recipes. So fish is fine, fowl is fine, and you have to be careful of the fatty meats, like feedlot beef. Regular steaks, beef cuts, and so on, unfortunately, are artificially fattened. In the feedlot process, they force feed these animals, giving them special chemicals to make them grow more fat between their muscle tissues, and it's an unfortunate event then for those who eat it. Because the average beef animal, if permitted to range feed or grass feed, they only have one-fifth as much fat in their body as a feedlot animal. And you can't get the fat out of the meat in a feedlot animal. You may think you're cutting it out around the steaks and so on, but the fat is in the marbling. In between the muscle fibers, you see those streaks of fat. You can't take that out. That's there to stay. And if you broil it and you say, well, it disappeared during broiling, it didn't disappear. It melted. You can't see it. Let it cool in your plate and it'll all come back when it solidifies. Now you're eating a tremendous amount of fat. In a good club steak and so on, you're eating 80% of the total calories in fat. If you want to get a really good fillet, you could be eating 85, 87% of the total calories in fat, only 12% protein. A slice of bread has more protein than a good fillet. So that, don't look upon it as a protein dish. Look upon it as a fat dish with as much fat as butter has, 82% total calories in fat. So as far as animal protein is concerned, most modern animal protein is just distorted to fill it with fat. It's like the old days when a goose was force-fed to give it a fatty liver. That was considered a delicacy. Well, we understand now that it is an unfortunate occurrence because it makes man sick. Now, many nutritionists have felt that animal protein is the ideal protein for man. How did all that start? Back in the early 1900s, Osborne and Mendel, early investigators, were working with rats, and they wanted to see what foods make rats grow best and grow fastest. And they found very soon that cheeses, dairy foods, eggs, and so on were very good for rats, but vegetable proteins didn't do too well. And so they started what they call a PER system, protein efficiency ratio. And they rated the foods. For example, egg was 94%. Well, that's almost 100% efficient. Cheeses, dairy products, meats, and fish were very high, 90 or 100%. Potatoes, only 67%. Beans and peas, only 42%. And in the early 1920s, as the investigations proceeded, investigators said there must be something wrong with vegetable foods. There must be something incomplete compared to animal foods because they don't let rats grow too well. And the term incomplete has been widely misunderstood by present-day nutritionists and dietitians. Present-day nutritionists and dietitians seem to think that the word incomplete means not all the amino acids. It's not a complete protein. That's completely untrue because when the term was first used, we didn't even know how to analyze for all the amino acids. When they said incomplete, they meant that there's something mysteriously missing because they don't make rats grow as fast as the animal proteins. And that, unfortunately, has stayed in the literature, the nutritional and dietetic literature, and so that many nutritionists, many dietitians are treating their patients like rats. They're referring them and recommending the rat diets instead of giving them human diets. Because when we talk about human diets, it's much different than the rat diets. For example, when we first started testing with humans to see the difference between vegetable and animal proteins, we get rather surprised. Dr. Knapp, for example, in his Corpus Christi hospital, treated young infants, 5 to 14 months old, on two different diets. One was a diet primarily vegetable proteins, and the other was primarily a milk diet. And he found it didn't make any difference to these infants. They all both grew just as well as each other as long as they got the same amount of calories. In fact, not only was there no difference in what we call nitrogen retention, that is, the amount of protein retained for growth and so on, and no difference in growth rates, but the children actually did better on the vegetable proteins compared to the milk proteins. Children were studied in India by Dr. Reddy. These children were 2 to 5 years old, and he was worried about giving them wheat, because in animal studies, wheat has a different amino acid composition and percentage than egg. And since egg is considered as the ideal protein by many, because it works well with rats, that we try to model all foods after the pattern of egg. And if the amino acid composition of other foods are not similar to egg, we think that it's inferior. Now, one amino acid called lysine is only half the quantity, half the percentage in wheat as it is in egg. So what Dr. Reddy did was to double the lysine content by adding it to the wheat diets to make it the equivalent to egg, to see if that helps children grow, because it does help animals grow. And after experimenting with these children 2 to 5 years old, he found no difference at all in growth as long as they had enough calories. So that didn't work out. Now, if you feed rats rice, plain rice, they hardly grow at all. But if you feed them rice and just add 1% chicken, the rats do pretty well. So Dr. Lee at Purdue University decided to take 20-year-old young men and see what happens to humans when you feed them rice diets. And he fed one group 100% rice, and the other group had 15% chicken and 85% rice. Let's see what happened. After a period of many weeks, when he checked them out again, he found that those on the rice alone retained about 20% more protein than those on the rice and 15% chicken. It was a real surprise. And yet the amount of rice that was used was only about 6 or 7% of total calories, one-third of what the average American eats. And that was plenty for these 20-year-old young active people. And more than that, the rice wasn't even worth eating. It was plain white starchy rice, all the minerals taken out, all the vitamins taken out, and all the dietary fiber taken out. Hardly worth eating, and yet the protein in rice was superior to that in rice and chicken. Now, humans are somewhat different than rats. Although some people think there's no difference between the species, at least nutritionally, there is a difference between the species. Now, Crofagny tried another test. He took men and put them on eggs as a principal source of calories and principal source of protein. And he found that the men required 9% of the total calories and protein when they're eating eggs to just balance out even. That means that they needed at least 9% to just get the protein they needed, and they had no excess of 9%. Now, when he changed their diet to make it 2/3 potatoes and 1/3 eggs, he found that they needed 30% less protein than they needed on eggs alone. The potatoes made the diet much more efficient for man than the eggs alone, so that when we talk about potatoes being inferior to eggs, that certainly doesn't seem to be true with man. So we learn quite a bit about the question of how humans react on vegetable proteins and animal proteins. There are other problems with high protein diets I ought to discuss. For example, Dr. Linksweiler of University of Wisconsin has been doing studies on 20-year-old young men, and she feeds them diets of different protein amounts. For example, she did a study where they were on a diet of 8% protein, 16% protein, and 24% protein. And she found on the 8% protein diet, when they had calcium in the amounts from 5 to 1,400 milligrams a day, that's equivalent to about a half a quart of milk to about a quart and a half of milk a day, that at all these levels, at 8% protein, at all these levels, these young people absorbed more calcium into their bodies and into their bones than they poured out through the urine. But when they got to 16% total calories and protein, and remember the average American eats 20% of their total calories and protein, at 16% they absorbed nothing from the milk. More calcium went out through the urine than they took in with up to a quart and a half of milk a day. And when they got to 24% total calories and protein, not any of them could maintain what we call a positive calcium balance. Everyone lost tremendous amounts of calcium through the urine compared to what they took in with up to a quart and a half of milk a day. The high protein diets force the body to take calcium out of its bones, if you don't have enough calcium in your diet, to neutralize the problems of the high protein diet. That's why I believe osteoporosis, or weakened bones, are so much an epidemic in this country. Because nutritionists tell us, and food manufacturers encourage us, to eat a high protein diet. This forces calcium out of your bones, unless you're drinking 5 quarts of milk a day, and you then develop weak and porous bones. Now, these are 20-year-old young men who are active, because if you're not as active as these young men, you're going to lose calcium out of your bones just from inactivity. So the high-protein diet is absolutely the wrong thing for man. The average American having 20% of the total calories in protein, it should be absolutely no more than 15%. Our diet would recommend 13%. And even if you're an experienced dietitian, you'd have a very difficult time figuring out a diet of natural foods that's less than 10% or 9% of total calories and protein. And yet, you can get down as far as 6 or 7% and not be deficient. So that, as far as protein deficiency, it's almost impossible to reach that level. That's the least thing we have to worry about in our country is protein deficiency. The big thing we have to worry about is protein excess. Because not only does the body chase out calcium through the urine, but it chases out magnesium, zinc, iron, phosphorus through the urine too. It minerally depletes you to be on a high protein diet. And not only do you lose the minerals, but you also lose bone structure. Now, Dr. Ralph Nelson, who is Associate Professor of Nutrition at Mayo University, Mayo Medical School, and he works with the dialysis group at Mayo Clinic, tells us that he's seen 20-year-olds that have been on these high-protein diets, a steak for breakfast and so on, already with kidney damage. Athletes, 20-year-old athletes, sort of a tragedy that the high-protein diet has been so misunderstood as to damage kidneys already at 20 years old with our athletes. Now, a high-protein diet has nothing to say good for it, and yet think of all the weight reduction diets. These are high-protein diets. The Atkins diet, the Stillman diet, the Scarsdale diet, and a good reason for these diets is that they do lose weight. And how do they lose weight? Well, they do it very simply. The high-protein diet is only about 75% efficient as far as going into calories. Almost one-fourth of the protein goes into waste products. We call these ammonia products. It's the same ammonia as you have in smelling salts. If you've ever smelled ammonium smelling salt, you know that it's a pretty strong material. Well, I can tell you that the ammonia is poisonous to your body cells, too. So the first thing that the body does is convert that ammonia byproduct from protein breakdown into what we call urea nitrogen and uric acid. And these now have to be gotten out of the body so the body doesn't become poisonous. And that's the principal constituent of urine. That's where the term comes from the urea nitrogens and the nitrogen waste products from protein waste. Now, on a high-protein diet, the problem is that the problems, again, are so toxic to the body, the body must dilute them with a lot of water to reduce their poisonous effect. It takes 7 times as much water to dilute the problems of protein digestive breakdown per calorie than it does of carbohydrates or fat. So that with that much water required, and if you're on a high-protein diet, you can lose 5 pounds of weight in 24 hours. How do you do that? Well, you lose 4.5 pounds of water to wash out all those poisonous products and maybe 0.5 pound of tissue weight. So that's why those in high-protein diets have almost an immediate weight loss in 24 hours. They've dehydrated themselves. Now, this is sort of a tragedy that children had. It used to be that infants, and especially premature infants, had these high-protein milk formulas like soy milk and so on fed to them. And these infants would die in 2 or 3 weeks of dehydration until they found out what the problem was. So that you certainly don't want to, for all the many reasons, be on a high-protein diet. Now you may say, well, if I can't be on a high-protein diet, and I can't be on the high-fat diet that I'm accustomed to, and I can't have all that sugar in my prepared foods. Incidentally, people say, well, how can I have so much sugar in my foods? I don't see the sugar. Well, you know, Jell-O has 85% of its calories in table sugar. The tomato sauce on a pizza that some of you had a week or two ago, the tomato sauce has 50% of its total calories in table sugar. There's table sugar in peanut butter. There's table sugar all over. It's all hidden in prepared foods. Now, there's no question about the amount of sugar eaten in our country and fat. Now, you might say, well, you've given me a number of examples of various experiments and so on vegetable protein diets and low-fat diets and so on. But these experiments are not necessarily valid for populations. Where is there a population that's on your diet? And how well are they doing? What kind of endurance can you have if you're not permitted to have animal protein at least twice a day to give you endurance and strength? That's a popular misconception, that animal protein gives you endurance and strength. Well, there are many populations on this diet, and one of the populations that I like to talk about is the Tarahumara Indian population. The Tarahumara Indians are in northern Mexico, about 60,000 people, and they're the blood relatives of the Pima Indians in Phoenix, Arizona. They split off about 400 years ago. Now, the Pimas, as some of you know, in Phoenix, Arizona, eat probably more calories than most people in this country. Probably 2,000 calories a day are eaten in fat alone, mostly lard. Most people get along on 2,000 calories for the whole day's food. They just eat that much in fat. They probably eat 3,500, 4,000 calories a day. Well, most Pima Indians are a little bit obese, but the tragedy of the Pimas is that with their high-fat, high-cholesterol diet, they have more than their share of the degenerative diseases that Americans have. They have more diabetes than any other group in the country, more arthritis than any other group in the country, and as far as gallstones, it's an epidemic. If you're 25 years old and you're a Pima female, 3 out of 4 of the females already have gallstones. Can you believe that? 75% have gallstones when you're 25 years or age or more as a Pima female. In fact, I think that the principal industry in Phoenix area among the Pimas is taking out gallbladders. So it's sort of a tragedy that the Pima Indians are in such bad shape. But let's look at their blood relatives, the Tarahumaras. The Tarahumaras are on the diet that I recommend to the percent, 13% total calories and protein. About 90% of it is vegetable protein, perhaps 10% is animal protein. They have animal protein 2, 3, 4 times a month, not too much, and their foods are very simple foods. Corn, peas, beans, squash, various native plants and fruits, and that's certainly not considered a gourmet diet by many. Well, let's see what sort of endurance these Tarahumara Indians have. Incidentally, there's no obesity with Tarahumara Indians. And also, out of the 60,000, they've yet to find the first case of heart disease. So as far as heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, so on, they just don't happen. They're just not known among the Tarahumara Indians. But yet, what kind of activity do they have? Well, for example, they love to play a kickball game. They have a wooden ball about the size of a large orange. And they have, let's say, 2 teams of 3 men. And each team kicks the wooden ball and runs at the same time. They kick it alternately. And these 3 men keep kicking this ball alternately. And the idea is to see which team gets to the goalpost first with their ball. They run continuously while they do this. It doesn't sound too exciting. It doesn't sound like you require too much endurance for that, except that the goalposts are 175 miles away. Now, it doesn't bother them. They simply run day and night for 48 hours until they get there. Now, the Tarahumara women, they also have a kickball game, but they don't have time to fool around like the men. They have to take care of the house, raise the children. So when they play their game, they run for only 50 miles. Now, if you get to the level of endurance that the Tarahumara Indians have, and you feel like you'd like to have a diet change to increase your endurance, let me know and I'll make a diet recommendation. But if you want to have real endurance, you can certainly do it on this kind of a diet. I don't know of a group around the world that exceeds the Tarahumara Indians in their endurance, their lack of diseases. In fact, in Tarahumara country, the people there actually have an opportunity to die of old age. That's something very rare in this country. In this country, you die of some disease. Tarahumaras have been known to do other things. For example, they've been known to run 500 miles in 5 days. That's quite a trip. For example, they can actually carry a 100-pound pack on their back, and they only weigh about 125, 130 pounds. They can carry a 100-pound pack on their back, and they can travel over 100 miles in just 2 or 3 days. That tremendous pack. So that they're very, very energetic people. And we certainly would like you to be modeled after them. Now, there are populations around the world that we've studied. For example, the Eskimos. You know, the Eskimos are on the highest protein diet of any free-living population. They eat 25% to 30% of the total calories in protein. And as we would expect, the Eskimos have one of the highest rates of bone loss from the high-protein diet. In fact, they have the highest rate of osteoporosis, or weakened and porous bones, in the world. And they get it quite early in life, so that we can understand why. Now, that's in spite of the tremendous calcium intake Eskimos have. They eat as much as 2,500 milligrams a day of calcium, which is like drinking 3 quarts of milk. But they lose more calcium than they take in with that tremendous amount of calcium intake. So it isn't going to help them. If they're going to be in that high-protein diet, they're going to lose their bones. Now, there are populations like the Bantus in Africa, on the other hand, that are on a very low-protein diet, and they're also on a very low-calcium diet. The average Bantu woman who is breastfeeding is only taking in about 350 milligrams a day of calcium. Let me tell you how much that is. The National Dairy Council and the experts in our country say that anyone in our country has to have as a minimum 800 milligrams of calcium a day. That's equivalent to about 3 glasses of milk a day. Well, how can the Bantus be getting only 350 milligrams a day and getting by? In fact, a lactating female, a woman that's breastfeeding in our country, is supposed to have at least a minimum of 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day. So how can the Bantus do it on 350 milligrams a day, almost one-fourth of what our requirement is? Well, first of all, in their low-protein diet, all the calcium they take in stays in the body. It isn't poured out through the urine. The second thing that happens is that the average Bantu woman has about 9 children during her lifetime. And she breastfeeds these children 2 years at a time. So she certainly is calling upon her calcium stores to take care of these. And yet, they don't have osteoporosis. The children grow up well. The women have strong bones and strong teeth, in much comparison to the problems in our country. So you can find many, many populations on low calcium diets that don't have any problems at all. Well, you might even say to yourself, well, how did it all happen that the American standards are so high in calcium? Because after all, 800 milligrams a day is higher than is met in almost any country in the world. How is it that we have the highest requirement for calcium in the world? Is there something wrong with the United States population that they need so much calcium and yet they have such weak bones? We have an epidemic of osteoporosis in our country. Weak bones as we get older, in spite of all the tremendous calcium that we have. Well, of course, we can understand that now, that the weak bones come primarily from the very high protein diet that will kick the calcium out of your bones almost no matter how much you eat. But the big problem in our country, and the reason why we require so much calcium, is very simple. We have an organization called the National Dairy Council in this country, and the National Dairy Council has only one purpose, and that's to encourage people to have dairy products. It's a pressure group by the dairy associations in this country. And they set the standards. Would you believe that the National Dairy Council provides the major source of nutritional information in the entire school system? Would you believe that the National Dairy Council, just a pressure group, provides more educational material on nutrition than the federal government, the state government, and the local governments in the school system? How is it that a pressure group happens to have a monopoly on nutritional information in our school system? That's why we require so much calcium, because the National Dairy Council said so. In fact, without the National Dairy Council, if you follow their teachings to the extreme, everybody better drink their couple gallons of milk a day, or else they're going to fall on their face. No, man was never meant to have milk after the wean. How long, after all, do you think cattle has been domesticated, dairy cattle? 5, 6, 7,000 years? That's all. How long do you think man has been evolving? Hundreds of thousands of years? What did man do 10, 15,000 years ago when the National Dairy Council wasn't around telling us we have to have milk? Man never had milk after his wean. There were no dairy animals to give it to him. There's no primate in the world today in their natural state that's ever had dairy products after the wean. That's not a natural part of man's life. In fact, there are many countries in the world that still have no dairy products after the wean. And there's a characteristic about humans and primates, and that the enzyme to that digests milk disappears after you're 4 or 5 years old. We found out that the hard way, because when we suddenly realized or thought there was a protein shortage some years ago among the poor people, that is, among the Indians, Africans, those in Thailand, and so on, so we shipped hundreds of tons of milk powder to alleviate the so-called protein shortage. Well, later on, we found it wasn't a protein shortage. It was just a calorie shortage. But we had to learn, and this is what happened, for example, in Thailand. The Thailand children were given the dry milk powder made up into milk preparation. They developed a diarrhea, and many of the children died from the diarrhea. Why did they develop a diarrhea? Well, they found out that 95% of these Thailand children, after they were 4 years old, no longer had lactase, the enzyme necessary to digest milk. They lost it. That's a natural state of man. Man was never expected by nature to continue drinking milk products, so the enzyme to digest milk disappears after you're 4 or 5 years old. In the United States, 25% of all whites don't have the enzyme to digest milk, 75% of all blacks. Now, dairy products are completely unnatural for man, and unfortunately, the National Dairy Council doesn't know this. Now, there's other minerals and so on that we're told to have, but I can tell you that if you just want to make a general statement, you're getting all the minerals you need from the natural foods that you have as recommended in my diet. If you'll eat your normal amount of vegetables and fruits, don't worry about minerals. You're getting all that you need. Now, as far as vitamins and so on, that's a big problem. The vitamin companies are pushing their wares just like it had to be, just like it really was needed. And I could talk about the many vitamins. I'll simply tell you that as far as vitamin A is concerned, don't worry about vitamin A. If you'll eat a carrot or two a week, you get all the carotene you need. The carotene will convert in the body to vitamin A, and that'll take care of you. So if you eat any amount of green and yellow vegetables, you're getting all the vitamin A you need. As far as vitamin B, eat your whole grains. You get all the vitamin B that you need then. And incidentally, the whole grains all have vitamin E too, far more than you require. Now, as far as vitamin D is concerned, if you're outside in daylight, it doesn't have to be sunlight, for at least a half hour a day, and you cover up your whole body except for one side of your face, your body will make all the vitamin D you need just by the daylight on your skin. Don't worry about vitamin D, unless you live in a cave and never go out. How about vitamin C? That's so controversial because of Dr. Linus Pauling. How much vitamin C do you actually need? Dr. Pauling says he takes 10,000 milligrams a day. Do you need that much? What do you need? If you had scurvy and you were bleeding in the mouth and the eyes and your gums, how much vitamin C do you think you need to cure yourself of scurvy? 1,000 milligrams a day? 10,000? No, all you need is 5. 5 milligrams a day will cure you in a month of scurvy. Completely cure you. And if you had 22 milligrams a day, you would saturate all your tissues. And more than 22 milligrams a day, the extra vitamin C would pour out through your urine. Now, one orange has 50 milligrams of vitamin C. So all you need is one orange a week if you had no other green and yellow vegetables. But vitamin C isn't everything. Vitamin C is in bananas, it's in potatoes, it's in practically everything that you're eating as far as fruits and vegetables. So don't worry about having a shortage. I think that the only question about vitamin C is, since you only need half an orange a day for vitamin C, the question is, how much vitamin C do you want to take? You might put it another way. How expensive do you want your urine to be? Rich in vitamin C that the body can't use. Now, Dr. Pauline has said a lot of things about vitamin C. For example, he said it helps people with heart disease. Somehow it helps clean out their arteries. Well, you know, Stanford University got tired of hearing this. They decided to run a test. And so they took people with high cholesterol levels and high triglyceride or fat levels, and they gave them 4,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day for a couple of months. At the end of the study, there was no change whatsoever in their cholesterol or triglycerides, but they did find something. They found a lot of extra material around that's just the right kind of material to grow cholesterol plaques. So if you want to grow extra cholesterol plaques or boils in your arteries, vitamin C may be a good thing for you. How about the problem of colds? Dr. Pauline's always saying that it's going to help you prevent colds. Well, that's all right until you do what we call a double-blind study where no one knows who takes the vitamin C, so they can't sort of guess the results in advance. And this is a study done with close to 900 Navajo children. And half those groups got 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day. The other half got what we call placebo, just a capsule that looked just like the vitamin C capsule, but nothing in it at all. And they took it for several months. At the end of the period, they checked out how many colds they had and how long they lasted. They found out that the two groups had practically identical amounts of colds. But there was one thing that was strange, and that is those who took the vitamin C, their colds lasted almost twice as long. Well, why should a cold last almost twice as long if you take vitamin C? Well, a recent study has taught us as to why that happens. Because if you take high amounts of vitamin C, this study has taught us that it can paralyze the white blood cells that eat bacteria and viruses. And so we can understand now that if you want to paralyze your white blood cells that eat bacteria and viruses, then maybe it's a good idea to have high amounts of vitamin C. And that certainly would explain to us why those who were on the vitamin C group had a much longer time to cure their cold than those who were off it. Well, there's a lot of problems, and I might say this. I'll just end perhaps by telling you about Dr. Cooper, who was a physician at the 1972 Olympics. And all of his athletes were taking vitamins, and finally Dr. Cooper sort of discouraged, and he said this, quote, "Vitamins need to be mentioned as another subject of the great drug myths. We must remember that vitamins act primarily as catalytic agents and are not metabolized, that is, are not used in the body. If a person eats a balanced diet of fresh, well-prepared food, he's getting all the vitamins his body can use. Americans excrete the most expensive urine in the world because it's loaded with so many vitamins. And, of course, then you have to decide how expensive you want your urine to be. So as far as food recommendations and dietary trends, let me say this. The concept of the fat reduction of diet is now being advocated by many professionals. The McGovern Committee recommendations, the new American Heart Association recommendations, and many are now saying you should reduce the amount of fat and cholesterol in your diet. The National Cancer Institute has come in with latest recommendations saying you must reduce fat in your diet and eat more whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. The health professionals are coming more and more to our recommendations, and I think you can take the advantage of being there first. So I certainly would recommend that your diet should be this way. Primarily whole grains. By that I mean whole rolled oats, whole wheat, and when I say whole wheat, I mean not only whole wheat bread, but pizza, lasagna, spaghetti, made to our recipes, and you can eat all you like and never have to worry about gaining excess weight. Brown rice, corn, barley, millet, the whole grains, these are your principal calorie sources. Fruits and vegetables, beans and peas, potatoes all day long if you like them, and limit your animal protein to a pound or pound and a half a week maximum. And we'd also all like to have you limit your animal protein so your cholesterol level stays below 160 milligram percent. That, the meaning of cholesterol, will be explained in the lecture on heart disease. That's your dietary recommendation. Stay with it, and now you'll be on the same kind of dietary plan that hundreds of millions of people have been on for hundreds of years. It's had a lot of experience, and in the countries that have used this dietary approach, the degenerative diseases like heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, breast cancer, colon cancer, and so on, are an insignificant part of the death rate compared to in our country, where it's a major part of the death rate.
Thank you.